You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 10th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, friends.
So, we are still facing, in the U.S., three simultaneous challenges, right? We got the
three,
COVID pandemic,
the up to two.
Subsequent economic... We're officially
yes.
in a recession this week. For the first
Forgot
time.
About that
yep.
one.
Yep. And, of course, the social unrest responding to police brutality and racism and policing, etc. So we are going to do an interview later in the show. We already did the interview, actually, but it'll be coming out later in the show with Angela Saini, a great interview about racial pseudoscience. It's a really fascinating interview. Going to just do a quick COVID update before we get to our news items. So actually a lot going on, man. There's been a lot in the last week. But first, I'll start with a personal story. As you know, I just finished 2 weeks on the wards, being inpatient. It's a veritable petri dish of COVID-19. But yesterday I got tested and I had a very positive test.
Wait, what?
Oh, no, come on.
It was positive, negative.
There you go.
Positively negative.
Oh. Yeah. But yeah, so I'm clean. But not a pleasant test. But first of all, they made me test myself. I had to stick that thing up my own nose.
What? Why? You had? But can you do that? Didn't you stuck it all the way to the back of your head?
Oh yeah.
Holy shit! I couldn't do that on my own.
Each nostril for 10 seconds.
That's and why did they have you?
I had it done a couple months ago, and it was just like, all right, here you go, boop. You're done. And then, but this time, 10 seconds in each nostril. I guess that reduces the false negative rate. So, and you got to go all the way back so that it really, really is irritating, and then you got to keep it there and spin it around. And it's like if your eyes aren't watering and you don't feel, you're not doing it right.
How many inches are we talking of this device inside of you?
Several. I don't know.
Many. I think that depends on your anatomy.
Okay. But I mean, there's a difference between 2 and 12.
No, it's all the way up to your sinuses, right? Like, it's not just in your outer nares. Like, it's all the way up,
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Right, Kara? Forget it. Forget it. I hope I don't have to get tested.
But anyway, so I'm happy about that. I probably should get tested in a week. Again, just to, because, there was a study recently showing if you get tested too early, the false negative rate is higher. So sometimes people are getting tested too quickly, before the virus is replicated enough that it will turn the test positive. But still reassuring.
Well, what's too quickly? What's too quickly, Steve?
Yeah.
It's not really clear. It's
a few days, right?
Yeah, a day or two. A few days is probably too quick. If you wait like a full week, then you're more.
Oh, really?
Assuming you got exposed. Remember, the incubation period can be up to 2 weeks. If you're testing yourself within a couple of days, you may still be 10 days away from getting symptoms, which is partly reflective of like how much of the virus has replicated in your body up so far.
How long did it take them to have the results for you?
6 hours. So we have a 2-hour test, but we ran out. Now we're just using the 6-hour test. But I got it the same day, which is better than last time. I had to wait like several days.
Mm-hmm,
that was earlier. That was earlier on in the whole thing.
Is it some sort of reagent where they can do it right there in the hospital, or do they still send it off?
No, it's in the hospital.
Oh, okay, that's cool.
So we're 111,000 deaths in the United States, still trending, trending down, but still, we're getting up to 1,000 a day. Or thereabouts on most days. So it's still happening. And, I've been looking a lot into just in terms of new infections. And if you look at the total United States, new infections are starting to level off and drift down. They're starting to go down a little bit. But I previously said that if you remove New York State, the rest of the country is going up. That was true up to a few weeks ago. But even today, if you remove New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Jersey, the other 46 states are going up still.
Oh,
that's not good.
So it's
I'm not surprised. Because I'm also seeing, even here in LA, anecdotally, some of the social distancing stuff is being relaxed, right? So even though we're still being told to wear masks, you still can't enter a store without a mask, things are opening up. I left my house today in my car and it felt like business as usual. There were lines places, there was traffic, and a lot of people were very laxed about their masks. Like when I walk my dog around the street, I see people with their mask around their chin. I see people not even wearing them. And it's like, I don't know, there's a false sense of security in the air right now.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Like we beat the virus and that is not the case.
It's not the case. And it's worse than that because we're starting to see the numbers turn up in states. And then the thinking is that we're seeing a little Memorial Day bump now.
Yeah.
And we don't know if this is just a little bump or is it going to be a second wave? We don't know. There's discussion about what the impact the protests will have. Again, this is not to criticize the protests, but everyone's like, yeah, you know, most people are wearing masks. It is mostly outdoors and that's good. But, you know, it would, you know, sure, it could absolutely contribute to a bit of a resurgence as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
A bunch of people in a tight space. Even, you're right, most people wearing masks, most people are trying to social distance, but people in a tight space is bad. People getting pepper sprayed is obviously going to contribute because people are taking off their masks and coughing everywhere. And then also just the sheer number of people that got arrested during these protests. If you really think about it, I sincerely doubt that there is a very rigid effort to prevent the spread in overnight, you know, jailings. I know that these are some of the worst places you want to be is in jail right now.
So, yeah, that's the whole discussion. And I wrote about it today. Like, what's the chance that we're going to get a second wave? Some good news. There is some recent research which showed that if we like really stick to our guns with wearing masks, wearing face masks, social distancing, hand washing, isolating if you get symptoms, we could theoretically prevent a second wave. But we have to keep doing those things. It doesn't mean that we don't open up the economy. It means as we're doing that, we're doing it carefully and we continue to do those precautions. So it not only would flatten the first wave, it could actually prevent further waves. That doesn't mean that it will be gone, but it just means it won't be going back up again. It'll just sort of be simmering at a low level. And hopefully if we can keep it that way until we get a vaccine or effective medications or more treatments, that would be great. But I'm a little pessimistic just looking at pictures of thousands of people on Memorial Day without masks and, you know, talking about, you know, having mass political rallies again. And I think, people are going to, have a false sense of security now and they're starting to relax. And we know now that these measures work. And if you don't do that, if you do them, it'll make a difference. And if you don't do them, it'll make things much, much worse.
It's like people think the rules have changed, you know, like, oh, we don't have to shelter in place anymore. Then I won't shelter in place. And it's like, no, you should still stay home as often as you can. You should still only go into places when you need to. It's not an one or the other.
Right.
It's like they don't get that the virus didn't go away. I don't know what the reasoning is behind people who think, oh, we're out of the woods now. We're in the exact same situation we were in months ago.
If you're not in the Northeast, the numbers are going up.
They're coming up with reasons to justify their old behaviors. And it's easy to fall back into those habits.
Well, I think the protest came at a perfect time, too. Like it detuned everyone. It gave everybody something else to think about. And now we're like, oh, back to normal.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I wonder if a lot of it is that like, I don't know if it's public education around, hey, we're going to make these steps now to try and get the economy back so that you can get working and so that you can have these essential things that you need in your life. But that doesn't mean, I feel like the second half of that sentence of like, that doesn't mean you shouldn't still be really vigilant is missing from the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really problematic.
Yeah,
like,
it is.
Like, until we have a vaccine, the risk is the exact same.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed.
Because it's been an insignificant number of people have been exposed. And so we have nothing approaching herd immunity. We're still a relatively naive population. And the virus is going to just keep spreading, you know?
Yeah. It's no different than it was in March or April when everybody was, you know, rightfully scared.
Yeah.
It and really did the isn't. Right thing and stayed home. But now all of a sudden it's like, they're like, this virus can't get me. It didn't get me yet. It's like, because you were at home, my friend.
Yeah. People need to read about the second wave in the Spanish flu in 1918.
Or
I think
need to read about.
I think in the grand scheme of things, when we look back, this will still be part of the first wave.
Yeah.
Total. I don't even think this counts as a second wave.
That's a good point. How will they define it?
Well, yeah, that's my point, that the second wave, if it comes, will probably come towards the end of the year, and people need to get, you know, be thinking about that.
Yeah, or early next. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So of the 14 last flu pandemics, 100% of them had second waves.
So we have to expect that this is going to happen.
We could do everything we can to stop it, but we have to plan as if it's going to happen.
Right.
So a recent study published in Nature found, they looked at China, South Korea, Italy, Iran, France, and the United States, and their models found that the lockdown prevented 62 million confirmed cases, which translates to a total of 530 million total infections. In the United States, that's, you know, over 5 million confirmed cases were prevented by the lockdown, which translates to about 250,000 additional deaths. So that's how many lives were saved by doing what we did. And of course, you know, other models, it goes both ways, showed that if we had locked down a week earlier, we could have saved 36,000 people. Maybe that number will go up as, you know, the death toll still rises. Similar independent studies just looking at Europe found the same thing, that the lockdown worked. And then if they'd done it earlier, it would have saved even more lives. So I think
every day,
the evidence is pretty good that, you know, David Gorski wrote about the fact that the evidence is a little messy, but bottom line, wearing masks works. Social distancing works. Hand washing works. And, you know, doing what we did absolutely worked. So, you know, take solace in that. But again, as we were saying, it's not over yet. It's not over yet. You know, this is where we get to we get into the long stretch of the marathon, you know, where we got to keep it up.
Yeah. And a lot of people are already in summer mode. They want to go out and party.
Also, just going to talk about this quickly. I mean, I have to talk about the Surgisphere fiasco since I've been giving the
Surgisphere
hydroxychloroquine updates. So this is a startup, a company that provided data for two studies that were published about hydroxychloroquine. And they claimed that they had 120 hospitals that were basically feeding them real-time clinical data from their electronic medical record systems. Not an implausible claim on its face. In fact, this was one of the big promises of having an EMR system, that you could gather real-time information and it could, you know, de-identify it so there's no HIPAA, you know, issues. And then you could do, it'll make research super easy. So it's like, okay, great, this should be happening. Like, that claim in and of itself sounds very plausible. But the problem is that it turns out that this company, you know, doesn't really have the data to back up their claim. That big study that I think we mentioned, where like over 90,000 people, data from 90,000 people were pooled, and showed not only does hydroxychloroquine not work, but there was a higher death risk among people who were taking it. So from the get-go, some experts were saying, this something fishy about this data. It's not squaring with other published data, and things are a little bit off. And the company's like, yeah, that's because we have real-time data. You know, they kind of poo-pooed it. So they said, okay, well, we need to start pouring through your raw data here. And they were like, no, we're not showing you our raw data. Then people started looking into the company itself, and it turns out that they cannot possibly have what they claim to have. First of all, they have only 6 employees, which rapidly decreased to 3 actual employees. And only one of them, the leader, is actually, he was a physician. The other two have no scientific or data analysis background. So it's basically impossible for a company of that size to be managing a database of this size. And there's no way that they built this relationship with 120 hospitals as quickly as they did. And a lot of these hospitals have no idea what they're talking about. So the whole thing seems like a scam, to be honest with you. So the Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine retracted the two studies. There's an investigation underway. So we have to basically just eliminate that data from looking at hydroxychloroquine. Doing that, if we scrub the meta-analysis of those two studies and anything else that might be tainted, what do we know? Hydroxychloroquine still doesn't work. It doesn't work as a preventive, doesn't work as a treatment. But there isn't enough data to say that there's an increased risk from it. So that does change. That was like the one study that solidly pointed to an increased risk. So if we take that away, it's like, okay, we're back to being not sure. But the evidence is still looking pretty solidly against there being any efficacy, although there are some more rigorous clinical trials that are going on. Some of them were stopped because of that study, but by the World Health Organization paused any of their hydroxychloroquine studies in light of that data, but they restarted them now. So this all happened pretty quickly in over about 2 week period, which is good. It's horrible that those studies got through peer review. Although we know that during the pandemic, there's like an expedited, you know, peer review process going on. And that's probably part of the problem as well. But it is good that it was discovered very quickly and expunged, you know. Doesn't change the bottom line. It still doesn't work. All right, let's go on with the news items. Bob, you're going to tell us about a new study looking into how humans see color.
With their eyes.
Yes.
Not really. More with their brains than their eyes.
Right? Well, the eye is an extension of the brain, is it not?
Yeah,
little bits of the brain. So researchers have recently shown that a surprising amount of color you see in your world is likely a construct of your brain. This is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Yeah.
I will not say it. This...
But
this,
it's so
of course,
fun, Bob.
Say it. Go ahead. Say it.
Tina.
Oh yes. This of course is a key tenet of scientific skepticism, right? Neuropsychological humility, self-deception, appreciating how easy it is to deceive ourselves. All the things that we need to know about, we are very familiar about, and have talked about for a long time. Our senses essentially present to us a photoshopped, deep-faked world. But there's no malign intent. It's just the brain's best guess at what's going on outside of itself. And the more we're aware of what it can do, the better we are. So in this news item, we see a novel use of virtual reality to expose that much of what we see is constructed reality and not reality. Follow?
Mm-hmm.
These studies dissect how little color people actually need before the brain says, I got this. Totally got this. And so in these studies, the researchers used head-mounted virtual reality displays, right? These are really getting powerful enough and cheap enough and available that you could start using them in ways that you know, maybe you hadn't thought of before, especially for interesting studies like this. So you've got these head-mounted virtual reality displays with integrated eye trackers, so it knows exactly what you're looking at. That is critical. So essentially, you have the people that participated in these studies have a 360-degree real-world environment, and they went through and they would see things like tours of historic sites. They would see street dance performances, symphony rehearsals, things like that. And there were no rules. They just look around, explore, turn your head, and just look at things. So, but what the researchers did was they would make changes on the fly, changes to the visual environment. So here I need to discuss exactly what peripheral vision is. We know what it is, but just for some of these facts. So imagine you put your arms out to the side of your body. That's roughly the extent of peripheral vision for humans, about 210 degrees. So straight ahead, now imagine straight ahead, fixed gaze. So whatever you look at hits the fovea on your retina, right? It focuses on the fovea. That's the business end of your retina right there. So that's where all the cones are there, which give you high resolution, high acuity, and color vision. The farther away then you diverge from that straight ahead gaze off of the fovea, the less cones and the more rods that are there. And the rods, of course, cannot see color and they don't have high acuity. Mm. So that's just the baseline of peripheral vision and what these researchers were focused on. So the researchers made sure that whatever you were directly looking at was in color. They could basically control any aspect of the visual scene in terms of whether it had color or not. So what you were looking at always had color, never changed. The scenes at the edges, though, of the peripheral vision, though, were slowly desaturated. No color, just black and white. So after time, more and more of your peripheral vision became black and white, getting as close as they dared to that very central area of your gaze that you were focused on, and that was always in color. That's the actual experiment that was done. So once they were done, they would ask the people, ask if they actually, did they notice that their visual scene, the entirety of their visual scene, huge chunks of it, the color was being wiped away. And very few people even noticed it. They were shocked. They were absolutely shocked when they were told what happened. They even did another study, the second study that they did, where they actually asked the people to specifically try to notice the lack of color at the periphery. And the results were very similar. If most of the color in the periphery is removed, most people did not notice it. More than 50% of the color was wiped away. Most of the people did not notice it. And if you look at the most extreme case, a third of the observers did not notice the lack of color, even when something like less than 5% of the visual scene was in color. So 95% was black and white. a third of the people did not even notice that.
That's so what I was interested in, Bob. So it was about the shift in the amount of the visual scene that was black and white, or was it about the saturation of the, you know, the
vividness
scaling from color to black and white?
Yeah, they refer to it as desaturated. They say that they were desaturating, so basically transitioning from color to just black and white. And so over a period of seconds, you'd have areas in your periphery that would become black and white. And then they would pull it back and have it color again.
Okay.
So the bottom line seems to be that people's color awareness seems to hover around the middle of their visual field. And the researchers say that it's important to know that this could not be explained by retinal neuroanatomy. It's not neuroanatomical. This is just something kind of a separate from that.
It's not just rods and cones.
Right, exactly. It's not and their distribution. And if you look at some charts about the distribution of rods and cones, be careful because you'll see a huge peak in cones in the middle of the visual field that ends pretty much, you know, at like maybe 10 or 15 degrees away. But that's not true. I mean, if you look more closely, there's rods. I mean, there's cones, you know, everywhere, but it's just, there's so far fewer of them as you go farther and farther away. I don't think it's ever completely just rods. And people can see color in their peripheral vision if it's a big enough splash of color. If it's big enough of those cones will be activated. But for this study, though, if you wiped away the color, people just did not notice. So I'll end with a quote by senior author Caroline Robertson. She's an assistant professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth. She said, "We were amazed by how oblivious participants were when color was removed from up to 95% of their visual world. Our results show that our intuitive sense of rich, colorful visual world is largely incorrect. Our brain is like filling in much of our perceptual experience."
That's what I was wondering, if it was like one of these things. We've all seen the optical illusions where, you know, it's not really a triangle because all the corners are missing, but your brain just fills it in, right? So you see triangles. I was wondering, right, if, you know, because I'm sitting here trying to like do this experiment. I'm looking at my bookshelf and it's really bright and my dog's off in my left periphery sleeping in his bed and he looks brown to me. But maybe that's because he's brown and I know he's brown.
So your brain knows to program it that way,
yeah,
or interpret it that way.
So no, Bob, totally. That age-old idea that orange to me is not orange to you, right?
This has nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, unrelated.
Well, but wait, I'm bringing it up because I still freak out about that sometimes.
Just quick and dirty on that. Obviously, there are going to be perceptual differences between people, like processing differences, but ultimately, light is actually measurable.
Yeah.
Like, we know what colors are because we can look at them.
But
like
Jay's talking about the qualia, the experience. Yes,
exactly. Qualia.
Right.
Qualia. But I think lots of times when that conversation is had, people forget that there is a certain nanometer measurement of light that our physical eyes are attuned to. Like our rods work in a very particular way and light works in a very particular way. So yes, your interpretation of that might be different, but what you see as red is what I see as red. You just might interpret it slightly differently.
Yeah, I mean, and there is actually some science to back up that certain subsets of people with specific genotypes that you can make an argument that the qualia is actually a little bit different. But to address your point, Jay, it's more like your brain knows what your orange is. So when that color goes into your periphery, it's going to make it be similar to that orange, not that somebody else's orange. It's still going to be your orange.
We can extrapolate from other knowledge about the fact that human brains are more similar than they are different. Yes, there's neurodiversity and it varies, but you know, the human brain's remarkably similar instruments. There's no plausible reason to think that two people perceive colors radically different.
Right.
There's probably going to be subtle differences.
Yeah, if somebody's not colorblind, because that's a different conversation, you'll probably be arguing, you'll be like, is this more blue or is this more, oh, that's green to me.
Is the dress
gold
or is the dress blue? Yeah.
Well, and that's different too, because that actually is like a weird perceptual F-up. But in terms of, you know, like shades and hues, that looks red. No, it looks more purple. Well, yeah, because it's ambiguous.
Yeah, and there are people that can see many more colors, as far as I could, from what I've read. They have some genetic aberration where they actually can see a lot more colors than other people. And that's actually a separate discussion as well.
Right. On a home garden show, I saw how the color yellow is very tricky because it all depends on what you put it next to. You take this yellow thing, you put it next to one color, it looks like this. You put it next to something else, it looks like something else entirely.
Mm-hmm. That's critical.
Color's relative. Color's relative. So the other thing that this points out, and I know we've mentioned this on the show at least once before, like if you hold your one of your arms out at arm's length, right, you put your thumb up, your thumbnail, right, if you look stare at your thumbnail, that's your fovea, basically. Everything outside of your thumbnail, you are legally blind. It's basically a blur outside of your fovea, and 95-96% of all of your visual information comes from that small area. The other several percent is the rest of your visual field.
Now, is that because the brain doesn't need to devote those resources? Is it unnecessary?
Well, it's also because of the anatomy of the eye.
It's a zero-sum game, right? We evolved so that our visual resources, which are vast, are dedicated to a small area of very highly detailed vision. That's obviously the most
and color, right?
Yeah, the most adaptive, and the rest of it is just a hazy, desaturated blur. And we just infer what's there. But it's really important for noticing movement, like if something is coming at us from the side. But we're not looking.
Yes,
it's much better to have really highly detailed information in a small area, and then a lot less information in a big area than to have medium information in a big area. Does that make sense?
It's also really important, not just for movement, but for seeing at night.
Like
outside of your fovea is actually better at seeing at night than your fovea, because your rods are better at seeing like that grainy darkness. And that's why sometimes like the middle of your vision, if you're looking through a telescope
at
something really far away, the middle of your vision is blurry. And you have to do this weird deferred vision thing where you sort of look in your periphery to see that nebula.
Yeah, and Steve, also about the tiny fovea, and that's why your eyes are going through what's called saccades or saccades, where your eyes are jittering very, very, very quickly, so that way it's kind of like spreading the fovea love around a little bit more, so you got a little bit bigger area.
I love that.
But we don't notice,
our brain fills it in. Stable.
And that's just it. Yeah. It's not like you're looking at 64-bit, computer graphics, and then out to the edge is like this 8-bit crap. Your brain kind of fills it in and makes it nice, and it doesn't look like it's such low res and uncolored. So your brain is very nice.
Well, I think what this is more relevant to, Evan, more than just like a monitor, is virtual reality. And what they're learning is that, don't need to have the whole virtual reality be high definition. We really only need the small part we're looking at to be in high definition.
And let the brain do the rest.
Let the brain do the rest. But that means you need eye tracking, which they're working on. So once you have eye tracking, and then you don't have to waste all of that, that processing power having 4K in your periphery, right? You only need to have it in the front of your vision. All right, let's move on.
All right.
So I teased this news item during our Friday live stream last week. If you guys don't know about that, every Friday, during this pandemic, and we're going to just keep doing it as long as we want to, at 5 o'clock Eastern time, we're live streaming just a chat with each other, and then with those who are joining us in the stream, answering questions on our YouTube and Facebook channel. It's been a lot of fun. And so last Friday, I sort of teased that I was going to talk about a news item that really showcases the willingness of some scientists to examine their own work and admit when they were wrong, right? Which is a key feature of how science is supposed to work.
Well, like Frances Arnold did recently, because she's awesome.
So this is about fMRI, functional MRI scanning, which we've had kind of a love-hate relationship with on the show and just as science communicators in general, because it's a powerful tool. And there's cool science coming out of fMRI studies. But it's also a very challenging tool, and there's a lot of crap coming out of fMRI studies as well. So this was a researcher, Professor Ahmad Hariri from Duke University, who just published a reanalysis of the last 15 years of his own research.
Wow. Cool.
And came to the conclusion that it all lacked validity.
Wow. Oh, no.
What?
He basically debunked his last 15 years of his own research.
Was that because of the thing we covered on the show quite a while ago about, like, the way that they count voxels in fMRI is actually not very valid? So, like, the processing software that a lot of studies were used?
No, this is a totally different problem.
All right.
Yeah, so it's not the processing of the software. This is just the paradigm that's being used to ask and answer questions. So,
Steve, it sounds like that guy lost a bet.
all right. So, again, and this realization didn't come out of the blue. The reason why he decided to do this study was because this is a core question of this type of fMRI research. I actually looked back through my own blog posts, and I wrote about this 11 years ago, this exact thing. So, again, this is not new, but he's like, all right, let's answer this question definitively. I'm going to recrunch all of my own data for the last 15 years and then see what I come up with. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is kind of like, It is all not valid. So, all right, here's the thing. So there's one type of fMRI research where you basically put somebody in an fMRI scanner, which measures blood flow to the brain, right? And then you infer that if a part of the brain gets more blood flow, that that part of the brain is being more active. It's processing information more actively. That's a pretty good assumption. So that's not the problem. And so we basically put them in the fMRI, and then we give them a task, and then we see what part of the brain lights up when they do that task. And then we infer from that, well, this part of the brain is involved in that task, right?
Well, and we actually average it out based on the background noise of the brain, too. There's a whole, like, subtractive thing we have to do.
Exactly.
I feel like it's left out of the conversation.
No, but that is the conversation, Kara. That's exactly the problem.
Oh, gotcha. This
is you're anticipating the problem. So the thing is, it's not as if one person does one task and their brain lights up in one location or several locations. We're like, ah, there we go. We could see it in real time. No, the brain is a cacophony of noise, and you have to do multiple trials with individuals and then multiple individuals. And then you're pulling a little bit of signal out of all that noise. But the idea is that, you know, that the signal's there. It's just lost in the fact that our brains, all of our brains are active all the time. And it's, you know, it is sort of activating that part of the brain, but it's just, we have to average out multiple trials in order to see it. But the question always is the low signal to noise ratio due to the noisy background, or is it due to the fact that the signal's not really there? Right? That's the question. So that's the question that he was trying to answer. And so one of the ways you can get at that question is to see if you do the same subject at different times on the same task, does the same part of their brain light up? And so that's what he looked for, sort of this internal consistency when you do test-retest analysis. So he did a test-retest analysis on his own research. And he found out that there basically isn't any. That,
oh, no.
Yeah, that if you ask the same subject to do the same task an hour later or a day later or a month later, there's basically no statistically significant probability that the same part of the brain is going to light up as it apparently did previously. So that's a huge problem for that entire paradigm of research. Of course, other researchers are going to have to do the same sort of thing. And this is going to, you know, require a lot of soul searching in this research field, right? So, but that's a problem. You would think if science works, you should get the same answer over and over again, right? That's the whole replication issue.
Unless it's like a psychological test where there are learning effects. But if you're doing something like playing poker in an fMRI, you're going to get the same excitement. You're going to get the same whatever each time you play poker.
All right. So what do we think is going on here? So it could just be that the signal-to-noise ratio is just too low to get meaningful results, right? Obviously, the brain is working, right? And different parts of the brain do different things.
He said doo-doo.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Here's one way to frame it, right? Uh-huh. And I've written about this a lot, too. This is sort of a very interesting conceptual question. How is the brain organized, right? And so that's sometimes framed as this. Is the brain organized as networks or modules, right? The module idea is that there are parts of the brain that do specific things. The network concept is that functions are a matter of different parts of the brain networking together. And so what it seems like is that both are true in that there are networks of modules, but the modules, the piece of the brain, right, isn't necessarily involved in a task so much as a type of processing. And that type of processing can be involved in many different tasks depending on what parts of the brain that module is networking with at any given moment. Right? Does that make sense? So if you just think of like the different parts of the brain is like these different sort of pieces of the brain that are all networked together, and then different networks will do different things, but the same part of the brain can be involved in different networks and have different functions at different times.
Right.
Not only that, but it might be quite possible that you could accomplish the same task, mental task, in different ways. So you're not necessarily recruiting the same exact networks when you're doing the same task at different times, depending on what else is going on in your head at that time, or whatever, what time of day it is, or how sleepy you are, or whether you've been primed recently with one strategy or another one. That, in other words, the complexity of how we think and how we do mental tasks is just maybe a layer or two more complicated for this paradigm of research.
Shit just got real.
The whole idea of looking to see what part of the brain lights up when you do a task may not be valid. That's
right.
That's the bottom line.
Or at least it seems like the validity probably goes up the broader or grosser the task becomes.
Sure.
So like if you're reading, you might have more consistency every time somebody reads in the scanner. But if you're reading something that evokes certain emotions, or you read, like, we're not going to be able to get that granular.
Exactly. I think, the more fundamental or basic, the more likely it is to be valid. The more abstract or complex, the less likely. But let me point out, though, that the fMRI is used in other ways for neuroscience research. And so none of this applies, for example, to using fMRI to map those networks in the brain. That is fine.
Right, just the basic kind of like non...
It's just that you could have multiple networks that are doing very, very similar things or the exact same thing, and you don't necessarily know it.
Yeah, but seeing what other parts of the brain does this part of the brain network with, that's fine. We can fMRI is a good tool for that. But the task-specific part is where we run into issues. That's the problem. Mm. And again, this is not coming out of the blue. This is a question that's been baked into this research for the last, as long as I've been following it, and I wrote about it 11 years ago. But this researcher, had the courage to look at his own research and ask this very fundamental question. And when it showed that his 15 years of work may not be valid, like, yep, we got to go back to the drawing board on this one, guys. I'm not seeing the test retest validity that should be there if this whole thing is working.
Well, nobody did it before? Nobody already tried this test retest?
It's really, so the culture in science is, it's very difficult for people to find funding and to find support, sadly, to do replication studies.
Internal replications.
We have to do it more, but like nobody does it.
It's I wouldn't say
it's
nobody.
It's not promoted.
It is. No, I know. It's not done that nearly. Like, I know, but I just want to overstate it, but it is.
Yeah, you're right.
And this is in science-based medicine. We've been critical of this for a while. And this is one of the things, it's part of the conversation of how do we make science better. And that's one of the very specific fixes that have been proposed, is that researchers should perform more internal replications before they publish their data. And that, because otherwise this happens, right?
The problem is it needs to be incentivized.
Yes, exactly. It needs to be incentivized.
The culture has to incentivize it.
The culture has to change. Culture has to change. Yeah.
Steve, so couldn't they, I would think if I came upon that study after I, cried and got drunk for a few days, I would think about it some more, and I would think, all right, let me try the same test in different times of day, different scenarios, just trying to change it up. And maybe he could identify like, okay, this task involves five different networks, I can never get it to do any other network. So maybe you can kind of get a handle on, what tasks use what type of networks, even if it switches from network to network, depending on the time of day. I would think you could expand that test.
That's not a bad thought, Bob. But the problem is that the more fundamental problem that because there isn't test retest validity, we don't know if the signal is real.
That's what I was about problem. To ask you, Steve. How does this relate to like the dead fish experiment and that big question that you asked at the beginning?
Totally. This is the dead fish experiment. This is that's a good, I forgot about that, but that's an exact that was pointing out this very problem, that you can pull a signal out of noise and we know there's no signal in a dead fish's brain. So that's the problem. Your fix, Bob, would solve the problem if it was only due to the variability in our mental function, but it doesn't solve the problem of we still haven't really proven that we're pulling a real signal out.
Right,
of the
that's the first thing you got to do. How about a mostly dead fish?
Yeah.
So that has more signal.
but here's the good news in all of this, because you know I'm an optimist at heart, is that this will move the needle forward, right? This will definitely push things forward. So negative results are still results.
Mm-hmm.
When one approach doesn't work, and then we say, okay, what are the fundamental ways we're approaching, we're thinking about this, and what could we rejigger? Like, what could we do to make it work? This is how we learn these and answer these deeper questions, like about how the brain works. By sometimes pursuing a blind alley and knowing, well, it's not that way, you know, and now we have to come up with some other way to try to imagine it. And then incrementally we get more and more sophisticated understanding of how things work. So this is part of the process. This is part of science.
I think the discussion section becomes much more interesting in these situations. I'm experiencing this for the first time. My research team, or a small group that we did one big kind of experimental endeavor together, is about to do a poster presentation, and we're actually thinking of publishing as well. Completely negative results. Like, we did not find a relationship between the things we were trying to find a relationship between. And it's a really interesting thing to write about, because we're like, why? And then there's a whole host of like open-ended questions. Is it because our sample wasn't good? Is it because there actually is no relationship? Is it because if we tried it this other way, we might be more likely to find a relationship? And that's, I think, a really interesting thing. And then, of course, in a perfect world, you could go on and do all of those experiments and try and answer those why questions.
Right, exactly. All right. Well, I thought that was fascinating. All right, Evan, you're coming at us with some more FRB news.
Absolutely. They are back in the news again because scientists from Australia have revealed that some FRBs are definitely not emanating from the centers of galaxies or from supernova collisions or anything else as dramatic and powerful. And we've talked regularly about fast radio bursts, FRBs. They are relatively recent discoveries, you know, the first being identified in 2007. That was only 13 years ago. Our podcast is older than that.
Oh, wow.
They are a mystery, a beautiful mystery. Astronomers still do not know exactly what causes them to happen, but they're chipping away at it. In the meantime, I'll give you a very quick review of what a fast radio burst is. It's in the name. Fast, these blips are very short, less than 5 milliseconds in duration. And 5 milliseconds, that is a honeybee's single wing flap, 5 milliseconds. So there, you can use that as your comparison. Radio, because the emission is a radio wave detected by radio telescopes surveying the sky at radio wavelengths. So there's that. And then bursts, because what? They're bursts. They signals, they disappear as quickly as they appear. Boom. What causes them? That's the big question. And we've been trying to figure that out. Now, there's lots of possible candidates as to what these things are. Among the list, it's a long list, supernova core collapsing, long gamma ray bursts, young magnetars, pulsars, or how about this one, Bob? Pulsars resulting from the remnant of young supernovas. That's been suggested. White dwarfs merging, or neutron stars merging, or black holes merging, and one of my favorites, cosmic strings, whatever the hell those are.
Oh, really?
I was going to say, sometimes I feel like when you guys do these cosmological or like these astronomical stories, I'm like, you're just making this up, aren't you?
Some of it,
you would think so.
Some of that's theoretical, like cosmic strings. They're theoretical. They think they may have formed in the early universe. They'd be one dimensional according to the theory, kind of left over from the early universe when it went through like some sort of phase transition. But that they've kind of fallen out of favor. That it's not as popular as it used to be. They've never been discovered. So, but yeah, if this led to some sort of discovery, like cosmic strings, that would be amazing.
That would be amazing. Whenever we talk about these FRBs or how they're reported and written about, it's usually in the context of large events or large stellar scale events happening, massively destructive big events, big things, the big things in space. But what if we were to discover that the FRBs, or at least some of the FRBs, originate from the parts of a galaxy which are, relatively speaking, more quiet, more calm, more stable, such as our own Milky Way galaxy? And in our Milky Way galaxy, our solar system occupies a space far away from the galactic center. We're out on the edge of one of the spiral arms of our galaxy. And for some non-repeating FRBs, this is what the scientists have figured out, and four of them specifically, they've been analyzed and determined to have originated from a part of their host galaxy away from the center, away from the galactic core, in the tranquil parts of the galaxy. That's very cool. This research was led by Dr. Shivani Bhandari of the CSIRO, that's the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research, which is Australia's national science agency. And they say that our study has found that FRBs live in massive galaxies which are forming fewer stars as compared to the galaxy of the famous repeating FRB 121102. And they said, we also found that FRBs typically reside in the outskirts of their hosts, ruling out progenitor models such as these related to the active supermassive black holes at the center of the galaxy. And this research was published this week in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. That is one of the FRB news items this week. And just the other day it was written about, it was reported, a mysterious pattern of cosmic radio bursts from distant galaxy repeats every 157 days. This is only the second time now we have an FRB with a repeating pattern that we can identify. Second time ever. This was in February. The scientists took the recordings and revealed that an object about 500 million light years away appeared to be transmitting signals every 16 days. Astronomers at the Jordell Bank Observatory were able to track emissions from FRB 121102, as I meant before, which has been studied for years. But this new recent discovery, this one sends out bursts during a 90-day window followed by 67 days of silence in a loop that repeats every 157 days. So we need more of these. They say it's an exciting result. It's only the second system where we believe we've seen this modulation and burst activity. Detecting a periodicity provides an important constraint on the origin of the bursts, and the activity cycles could argue against a precessing neutron star. So slowly chip away, with every new FRB discovery, every new piece of information, they're putting the puzzle together. Again, it's relatively new. I mean, really, they've only been studying these things for about 13 years, and they've already, been able to determine a lot of things. And I hope this becomes a mystery that gets solved within our lifetime, and I think it will be.
Yeah.
So wait, what did I miss it? What do they think this one with the super weird periodicity is?
No, this one is, they didn't talk about the origin specifically. This, not to confuse with the first news item, this is two different news items.
Right.
So apparently this one, which does have the repeating aspect to it, although I didn't read it specifically, they inferred that it is coming from something closer to the core of perhaps one of these galaxies, as opposed to being on the outskirts or in the quiet parts of a galaxy.
But it sounded like you said that they were saying that it's not a rotating neutron star.
Yes, this cycle argues against a precessing neutron star.
It's a cool mystery. I wonder if it'll be solved while we're still doing our show. That'll be cool.
I hope so. And there's news practically almost every week coming out about these things,
right,
it seems now.
Right.
So they've got a good beat on these things. They're learning how to detect them with more frequency, and that will help accelerate the process.
Absolutely. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. What is going on there?
Well, I definitely hear, the sound of some machine spinning up.
Mechanical, that's what I would
guess. Yeah. Creepy.
And it, like it, that could be consistent with a saw. You know, it's like a circular saw. It spins up and then it cuts something metal. That's what I think I'm hearing.
Well, so a listener named Caleb wrote in and said, Jay, going to go with the obvious guess and say that this is a souped up coffee grinder.
Obviously.
You do love your coffee.
Incorrect, but I would use a coffee grinder that made that sound. Nicholas Underwood said, hey, my dude, sounds like a CNC or maybe a circular saw working through some wood, then hitting perhaps some metal or fiber composite attached to the wood. I used to be around a CNC that would cut through mixed material, and it made some bitchin' sounds.
Nice.
That is incorrect, but moving in the right direction. My Roman warrior, Visto Tutti, wrote in. Yeah. He said, I can hear a lathe spin up and some cutting noises. Sounds like an automated machining of some part. When the part drops, it sounds like glass. So I'm going to say manufacture of corrective lenses. Indeed, a lathe is involved of some kind, but everything else is not correct. The winner for last week, Greg Richards. That sure sounds like metal spinning. The clanking noises are from the metal worker re-indexing the spoon used to press the metal against form. So, what is metal spinning?
Oh, so it's not like metal spinning. It's metal spinning.
Yeah, so what you see in the video is it looks like there's a on a lathe, right? So that's like a thing that just spins. And a lot of people would use a lathe, for example, to carve a huge piece of wood. And they have a bar and they hold a sharp piece of metal, which essentially is cutting the wood, but the wood is spinning around in a circle really fast. So metal spinning is when you put a like a disc shaped, say it's a big disc, looks like a cymbal, right? Like a drum cymbal. And they have it on a lathe and then they use a tool to bend that piece of metal.
What do they make with it?
All sorts of stuff. Pretty much anything that you want to, shape metal into, you know, a vase. You know, I'm pretty sure that like some cymbals are made that way too.
I was going to say, what about a drum cymbal?
Yeah, I know that they're pressed. I know drum cymbals are pressed, but they could do some shaping. You know, I remember watching a video about 3 years ago about it. But anyway, the bottom line is that this is called metal spinning. It's spinning metal and it's being shaped. So take a listen again and you'll hear it when the tool hits the metal. There's the lathe. There it was.
Wow.
Yep. Really cool. Thank you for sending that in, anonymous who's that noisy listener.
John Smith from Virginia.
John Smith. I have a new noisy this week. This was sent in by a listener named Aaron Carlson. So there it is.
Well, I heard the bird.
So yeah, this bird one is subtle. Singing. There are background noises that may or may not help you figure out what it is. I don't think I need to give any clues on this one. I think a lot of people are going to guess this one correctly. So what is that? What is making that noise? If you have any ideas, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thank you, Jay. So we have one question, Jay. This is for you as well, right? This is just a follow-up to your discussion last week on the International Space Station. We were talking about the fact that we didn't know if there are any plans for anything to follow the ISS, but apparently there are.
Yeah, there's a few other points of clarification because I couldn't find all of the precise info that I wanted. So the Demo 2 mission, which we all got the pleasure of seeing happen over the last week and a half, it really was first scheduled to last for a week. The astronauts were going to be on the space station for a week and come back, but then they decided to extend it from 1 to 4 months, and this depends on how long the Dragon 2 capsule's solar panels are going to work, because they don't have a limited unlimited lifespan. So it's still a further test. And, you know, again, Kara, remember you were like, why is it, they're still like demonstrating the capsule? Yeah, they're still testing it out.
I don't remember that.
You said it. You were very upset about it for some reason, very angry at it.
Oh, I was saying like I wouldn't want to be on the demo.
Yeah, like on a demo mission, but like, they have to do it.
Finish the demo before you do like a real crewed mission.
Now, the other thing that resonated strongly with us was the fact that they're not going to use the Super Draco engines to land, dry land, the Dragon capsule. They're going to use the chutes, right? And we were questioning, why was that? And, you know, did they not function as well as they wanted to, whatever? So here's what it turns out. It turns out that NASA didn't want them to risk a dry landing and use the retro rockets because it does increase the, you know, the chance that something bad can happen. So they ultimately decided that for this first mission that they're going to use the parachutes as it comes down, and that those Draco engines will only be used to execute the launch abort, which is when they're still connected to the rocket, whatever rocket is sending them up into outer space, they can abort and get rocketed away from the main fuselage and then come back down to Earth safely. So, you know, yet to be seen whether or not we'll see those retro rockets carry people in the near future, but eventually it's going to happen, I'm sure. Now, another fact that we talked about is how reusable is the capsule. But NASA wanted originally to have a fresh capsule for every crewed mission, right? Then SpaceX decided, you know what, we'll use the Dragon capsules that have been in outer space before to bring up cargo from here on out. Like, so mission one will be people, mission two and on will be cargo. But then NASA has recently decided, and I mean very recently decided, hey, you know what? These are safe enough to reuse. So I guess we're going to start seeing, you know, missions two, three, and four with people on them at some point. Maybe not the very next couple of missions, but soon, I'm sure. It feels like NASA realized and did their research and found out that the technology is there. So that's awesome. Now, another listener emailed me and wanted to point out that there is actually a planned NASA follow-up to the ISS, so here's what's actually happening. The company is called Axiom, and Axiom actually was a hugely involved company in the construction of the ISS, the original ISS as we see it today. So sometime in 2024, the Axiom missions are going to begin. Now, here's what it is. There's a series of modules that are going to be launched and connected to the existing ISS. The first module will have an amazing observation area. And I'm telling you guys, I saw artistic renderings of this. It is amazing. It's huge. It's like a huge unobstructed view of the Earth that you drop into. So when the astronauts are up there, they're going to open a hatch and they're going to go down into like a glass, you know, it's not really ball shaped. It's more, you know, long than it is a ball shape, but about 8 plus people can fit in the thing. It's huge.
Down the hatch.
And it's mostly huge glass. You know, whatever material they're using that's transparent. I'm sure it's not really glass, but
it's transparent aluminum.
It's going to be probably one of the best human experiences ever to observe the Earth inside of this thing.
Hell yeah.
So the second module that will go up is going to be a habitation module that can fit up to 8 astronauts. And this module has a lot of open space, and it has also another really big observation window. It comes with a large computer screen. You know, when I say 8 people can fit in it, it looks like 8 people can fit in this module comfortably. Again, comfortably for space. Much, much better than any accommodation that currently exists. And it looks really like it's out of 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like, it's really stylized and cool looking. The third module is for research and manufacturing. And this is where private companies are going to be able to rent time, send people up, and be able to do different types of work up there. And then the final addition is the power and thermal control module. So the first three modules will be relying on the power in the thermal control from the ISS. Now, this module will allow them to operate on their own. And this module will also give them the ability to do EVAs, right? It has an airlock for EVAs, which is extravehicular activity, right? People leaving the space station. That's basically what that means. It's possible some other modules could be taken from the ISS and then moved to the Axion segment, right? And then finally, when the ISS is decommissioned, what's going to happen is the Axion segment will detach and become its own space station. So just think of it as a slow transition. They're going to be bringing up these modules. They're all going to be connected to each other and have one primary connection to the existing ISS. You know, this unit will have its own solar panels. It'll have a robotic arm. And then at some point from 2028 on, when they decommission the ISS, this thing detaches and becomes its own commercially owned and operated space station.
Neat.
The other cool thing I found out is that all of these modules have their own propulsion and guidance control systems. So once they're brought up into low Earth orbit, they can orient themselves individually as well. and meet other spacecraft, even though they are connected, they still can operate on their own. And this new station is absolutely intended for commercial use and expecting visitors. So this is probably where, you know, the first regular person that pays a ton of money is going to get up into outer space and get to live on this new space station.
They could theoretically do that indefinitely, just keep adding new segments and decommissioning old segments with having total continuity, you know, of the station, right?
Yeah, yeah. You'd think, though. So think
like
about
how our
that.
Body replaces our cells.
Yeah,
like eventually we have a whole new liver.
Well, think about all the stuff that's up in outer space right now. Now, yeah. So they're going to decommission the ISS, and it's going to get airdropped. You know, it's going to have to get. It's going to be
deorbited,
and it's going to burn up.
Like all right, thank you, brother. Joining us now is Angela Saini. Angela, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you are a science journalist and author, and we were hoping to talk about your most recent two books, actually, Superior, The Return of Race Science, and Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong and the New Research That's Rewriting the Story. I mean, these kind of both work together, I imagine, but let's talk a little bit about the first one. The Return of Race Science. So I actually didn't know that it went away. But so tell us about the history of it. Why did you frame it that way?
No, you're right. It never really went away. And that is because in some ways, these ideas that we have about race, many of them not very scientific, have been there since the very beginning, since kind of the birth of modern Western science. And in some ways, they're the bedrock upon which modern human biology is built, our understanding of human difference. And so as much as now for the last 50, 60, 70 years, we've known that race is a social construct, that race maps very poorly onto real human variation, and certainly has next to no genetic basis, we still resort to it all the time. And you see that happening in health and medicine, particularly, but also in areas like population genetics. In fact, we even saw it play out now during the coronavirus. We've seen, you know, certain groups, certain populations die at faster rates than others. And people have kind of leapt to the possibility that there might be genetic explanations for that. But also in recent years, we've seen a resurgence in scientific racism among the alt-right and the far-right, and that certainly does have political consequences.
And in your research for the book, did you find pretty clear cultural continuity, if you will, between sort of the more modern manifestation of race science and, say, the eugenics of the early 20th century or even older versions of scientific racism from the previous century?
Well, it's difficult because people do ask me, has racism been around forever? You know, are people kind of naturally predisposed to be suspicious or wary of other people who don't look like them or who belong to a different tribe or a different group? And that's possibly true. I mean, we do show preference to our own family, our own kin, than others. And of course, traditionally, people have tended to live in communities that they have been at least loosely related to, just because that's the way communities work out. You know, you marry within your community, at least in the past. We don't tend to do that now. So that's possible. But the way that discrimination and xenophobia and notions of human difference play out are different in various parts of the world. So I do look at issues around white supremacy in Superior, but I also look at, for example, casteism in India. Mm-hmm. So my parents are from India. They're British now. And casteism is the big kind of cleavage in America, in Indian society. It is how discrimination works in Indian society by and large. There are other forms of discrimination, but caste is the overriding one. In British society, traditionally, not so much these days, but arguably maybe, it's classism that has been the big kind of issue and the big focus of discrimination. This idea of the lower classes being somehow inferior to the upper classes physically, mentally, in lots of different ways. And in the US, I think it runs along racial lines. So it is about color. And this is largely because of the history of slavery and colonialism in the US. So it's different depending on where you go. But as I think I landed when I was writing my book, was that it is almost always about power. It's about a dominant group that happens, for whatever reason, for economic or historical reasons, to oppress another group sooner or later. Not everywhere, but in many instances, they start to frame that dominance as natural, as though it's rooted in something innate to them, that they have something that the oppressed group do not have, and that is why the oppressed group are oppressed, and that the oppressed group is inferior in some biological way, in some natural way. And that really is the basis, when you think about it, of race science. I mean, when these categories were invented during the European Enlightenment, I'm talking about the categories we use now. Race has been defined in various different ways throughout time. But the way that we use race now, the categories we refer to, were thought up, dreamt up around the time of the Enlightenment by naturalists in very crude and arbitrary ways. I mean, so crude that if you think about it, they just make no sense. I mean, black, white, red, yellow, brown, they're just so vague as to have almost no meaning. But they have had meaning attached to them by politics, by the weight of history, really, the weight of slavery and colonialism and genocide and all this kind of layers of meaning placed upon them, to the point where now we can't imagine a world without them. They are as real to us as anything else. The fact is, though, they just were never real in biology.
Yeah, that from what you're saying, science then is just a justification for the racism that is there for other reasons, namely to justify a power differential, much in the same way that other things have been used, like religion, right? Before science, it was, well, God made us superior to whoever we're oppressing, right?
Yeah, and I think people reach for lots of different explanations for power hierarchies to maintain certain power dynamics within societies. Religion is certainly one of them. And in fact, you see this play out in really interesting ways. In India, for example, under the current Hindu nationalist government, there have been exhortations, of course, to religion, but also to science at the same time. There have been efforts to look for scientific proof of things that are written in Hindu texts.
Mm-hmm.
Under Nazi Germany, many decades ago, there were efforts to try and prove the existence of a Germanic race, and that if we could find then existence of this Germanic race outside German territory, then that territory could be rightly claimed. So it comes down to origin stories, it comes down to nationalism, and it comes down to power.
What about the idea that, you know, if you were to talk to someone today in the United States, as an example, and you say, you know, you pose this to them, they would say, well, I'm not in a power struggle with black people or white people or anybody else, right? You know, I could understand back when black people were indentured servants and slaves, right? There was a use, but today, what's the actual power struggle, or who's benefiting today from it?
Well, there is still a power struggle. I mean, the far right, the alt-right, use these scientific racist arguments very often in order to make claims about superiority. There are many people who try and justify inequality as it exists, racial inequality, on scientific grounds. And this is a very powerful political argument. It's been made for a very long time. And this is one reason, I think, that scientific racism doesn't disappear. Because if you can make the claim that the inequality that we see, the pay gaps, the fact that black Americans have lower life expectancy than white Americans, if you can explain a lower employment among black Americans, all these different discrepancies and disparities that you see in society, if you can say that that is natural, that is because black people are innately different to white people, which many people still claim that they are, then you don't have to do anything about it. We don't have to fix anything in society. And that is the power of that argument. And that's why so many people out there, many more than we would like to think, try and make this claim in subtle ways very often. But fundamentally, this is a claim that they're making.
You know, it feels really big because it is. It's institutional. It's systemic. But it's so interesting to me how often on my social media feeds, when I'd be sharing information that kind of like amplifying Black voices during this Black Lives Matter movement and sharing information about inequality, how many responses are so ignorant about that very fact that you just made. How many people might say, well, didn't you ever think that maybe more Black people are in prison because more Black people are criminals? Didn't you ever think, you know, and I see this all the time. I remember sharing the footage from the doll test showing these young Black children, toddlers, pointing to the Black doll and saying, that's the ugly doll, and pointing to the white doll and saying, that's the nice doll. But then at the end, pointing to the Black doll and saying, that one looks the most like me. And so many responses on these posts that I would make would be people saying, well, maybe there's just something innate that we're more drawn to lightness than dark. And I'm like, wow, really?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so prevalent that people are willing to say it out loud.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if we've become more unashamed of saying these things out loud or whether they've always been there and the internet kind of gives them a voice now that they didn't have before. But certainly those views have always been there. I mean, colorism certainly has always been there in many different societies, and it's not, and it's ugly, and there is no justification for it, and there's certainly no biological justification for it. Often I hear people invoking biological explanations for the prejudices that they see, and it makes them feel better. Because if it's biological, if it's something natural, then you're not really a bigot, are you? Then you're just playing out what is human nature.
Angela, I wanted to ask you real quick. There's a passage at the very end of the first chapter in Superior that I highlighted. If you guys don't mind, I want to read. It's a very short paragraph, but I think it brings it back to these basic science questions that are so important. You said, people everywhere of all political persuasions find it easy to buy into the idea that biological race means something. This is a problem for science. When Enlightenment thinkers looked at the world around them, some took the politics of their day as the starting point. It was the lens through which they viewed all human difference. We do the same today. The facts only temper what we think we already know. Even when we study human origins, we don't actually start at the beginning. We start at the end, with our assumptions as the basis for inquiry. We need to be persuaded before we cast aside our prior beliefs about who we are. The way new research is interpreted is always at the mercy of old ideas. And to me, that's the crux of, like, the entire book. It's the crux of these arguments that you make about how race science has, in many ways, pervaded all of at least biological science, that we are human beings doing this process. And I think so often skeptics, I'll feel a lot of pushback from skeptics when we start to talk about things like race, because they want to be these kind of logical positivist purists and say, no, science doesn't care about color and science doesn't care. And it's like, well, but science is a process that's done by people, right?
Yeah, it is. And I have to say that the skeptic movement is not great on this. So in Inferior, which is my previous book on gender, near the beginning, I recount a story of when I gave a talk and this man came up to me afterwards and just spouted off all this kind of sexist and racist abuse about women and non-white people just not being as smart as white men, essentially, like him. And what I didn't say in that book was that happened at a skeptic meeting. So I was speaking at a skeptic group in the UK. And I think there is this strange phenomenon within kind of rational groups and skeptic groups where there is such faith in the power of science to deliver perfect facts, that when faced with the possibility that science might, in fact, have been biased, or it might be skewed in some ways, and the results and the stuff that scientists have said in the past might be prejudiced or and might not be accurate because of their prejudices, they just react really badly. They don't want to hear it because science in that sense becomes almost like a religion then. You know, I studied engineering at university and I was raised in exactly this kind of way of thinking, that science is all about facts, it's objective, it is delivering a kind of value-free version of the world. These are absolute truths that it is delivering. And actually, when you look particularly at human biology and psychology, the science of human behavior, it is anything but. And the reason for that is that we are humans studying other humans. We change all the time. The questions that we ask, the theories that we draw from the questions that we ask, from the things that we observe, are always obviously going to be impacted by what we can see and what we believe and what we've been raised to believe. And this is why, you know, come back to the Enlightenment, and I'm not knocking the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, of course, gave us this wonderful empiricism and this kind of retreat from superstition towards rationality. But also at the same time, it was built upon political assumptions that, number one, women were not the intellectual equals of men, which is why most European universities and certainly all the European scientific academies banned women as a matter of course up until the middle of the 20th century. And also that non-white people are not the equals, the intellectual equals, and sometimes not even the physical equals of white Europeans. And that also informed so much of science for the next 200 years. So much so that in the 19th century, there were people that believed that we were subspecies. And this was mainstream thinking. This wasn't even marginal thinking. It was quite mainstream and acceptable to believe that races were had evolved separately as different species, and that some were more evolved than others. That some races, as they were called, were doomed to die out because they were further down the evolutionary ladder. And then that justified genocide. I mean, what happened in Australia? Well, one of the first policies in Australia, the White Australia policy, essentially tried to breed out the colour from Aboriginal Australians. And that was informed by science. Science at every step was a handmaiden to that politics. It didn't condemn it. It didn't challenge it, although there were voices that did condemn and challenge throughout. But by and large, it helped. It supported all this politics all the way through, even though the science was completely shoddy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it feels like, you know, there's an ideology, or maybe I shouldn't even say an ideal, but an aspirational nature to science that a lot of people confuse with the actual nature of science. And sadly, if you forget about that disconnect and you forget to continue to aspire to try and find unbiased information, then you start to settle into the false idea that the information you have is actually unbiased. And then you become complacent and you don't iterate and you don't actually improve your science. Yeah, exactly. And
the ultimate bias is the thought that you don't have any biases, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that it short circuits, as you say, the self-corrective aspect of science. So,
yeah.
But I do feel obliged to defend skepticism a little bit. I'm sorry you had that experience at a skeptics meeting.
I have had so many of those, by the way, Steve, at skeptics conference.
I hear you. I hear you. So we absolutely acknowledge, first of all, the skepticism is a very multifaceted, very loose movement. We jokingly refer to, you know, the organized skeptics, herding cats, right?
That's like atheist conferences. It's like, come on. So we're all combined by what we don't believe in.
Yeah.
This is
so there's exactly. There's a lot of different cultures, politics, ideologies that will sort of merge under this umbrella, and some of them are contrarians. They're not really skeptics. Others are just, they think they're skeptics, but they're still overwhelmed by their biases and their politics.
They're deniers.
But I do think there is, you know, what I consider to be like the core of the best sort of intellectual skeptics who are out there totally recognize that science is a human endeavor, and that's what we write about almost daily in the the parts of the skeptical movement that I'm involved with. It's
right, yeah, cognitive biases. Like every that's like the core of everything we talk about.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of pseudoscience in every science, right? But we're just trying to minimize it by constantly being vigilant about that. So it is multifaceted. So I wouldn't let that experience color your view of all skeptics.
I speak at lots of different skeptic groups, and many of my friends belong to skeptic organizations. I write for the New Humanist here in the UK very often. So I'm kind of ingrained within these circles as well. But what disappoints me sometimes is that that the spirit of skepticism, which should want science to be better by challenging itself, as you say, isn't always there. And maybe that's what we need to foster a bit more.
No, absolutely. Yeah, and that's, I think, what we try to do. So I do want to discuss a little bit about the idea of, is there any biological reality to the concept of race? Because I am anticipating the kind of questions that, or the kind of feedback that we're going to get. And we did discuss this in quite a lot of detail on the show previously, this idea that, yeah, race, you know, at first approximation basically doesn't exist because there's way more variation within any identifiable population than there is between different populations. But at the same time, and I'm also coming at this as a physician, you know, genetic variants, alleles are not uniformly distributed among the population. Like, I know that, to give a blatant example, the probability that I have sickle cell anemia is pretty close to zero. And I could say that based entirely on my ancestry. And if somebody does have sickle cell anemia, I would wager a lot of money on what continent their ancestors come from. So from a medical point of view, we do need to know, you know, what genes you likely have based upon your family history and the population from which, you know, your genes come from. But that's not the same thing as saying that race is a real biological construct. But
yeah, it's not even the same thing as race, right? I mean, it isn't. We're just talking about ethnicity.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's population. You know, like Ashkenazi Jews have certain genetic diseases. There's founder effects and things like that. But that's, I do think people confuse that with race, I think is the point that I'm making. But there is that nuance in there that if you don't address it, people say, well, wait a minute, that what you said isn't true because diseases do vary by your ancestry.
Yeah, but they don't vary in quite the ways we imagine. And sometimes there can be demographic effects here. So just coming back to sickle cell, which is a really good example, because this is quite a clearly racialized condition. So you're right. In the US, it does run along racial lines because Black Americans tend to be, because of the history of slavery, of West African ancestry, where sickle cell is prevalent. And white Americans tend to be of European ancestry from regions where sickle cell isn't prevalent. So in the US, demographically, it does look like a black-white condition. But globally, of course, it doesn't, because there are many parts of Africa in which sickle cell, I should say, exists at all. It has survived at all because it confers some resistance. The trait confers some resistance to malaria. Mm-hmm. So it's found in those regions where malaria is common. Now, not all parts of Africa... Not in all parts of Africa is malaria common. So you don't see sickle cell all over Africa. And also there are parts of the world in which people have light skin in which you do see it. So globally, it doesn't run along black-white lines quite as clearly as it does in the US for demographic reasons. And even then, it is seen in white populations. So much so, as I explain in the book, when there were attempts a while back, or that this idea was mooted a while back, to only, in some states, only test black babies for sickle cell because it was seen as more efficient and cost effective to do that if it was so much more prevalent in the black population, which it is. But when you look, when you break down the demographics, the order of magnitude, the order of magnitude of likelihood of seeing it in black, in a black baby versus the likelihood of seeing it in any baby is almost the same. And this is why in those states they decided to screen irrelevant of race, regardless of race.
Interesting.
So I think we do have to be careful about local assumptions. And also we have to remember, in the US, what does it mean to be black? Historically, that racist one drop rule, you can have one black grandparent, and if you look black, you'll be categorized as black.
Mm-hmm.
You'll put on the census form black. So what does that mean genetically?
No, absolutely agreed. Yeah. Yeah. And as we pointed out, that the genetic variation among the different populations in Africa dwarfs the genetic variation for the rest of the world.
Right.
It's ridiculous to say, all right, 98% of the genetic variation we're going to lump under one race. And then, you know what I mean? It makes absolutely no sense. But I agree. Again, it's not a racial divide. But to some extent, there are differing probabilities based upon regional. It's basically regional adaptations, you know, and to what extent they persist. Of course, the more we are outbred, right, the more people are moving around the world, the less those differences are starting to average out over time.
They exist. I mean, sickle cell is often brought up as an example because it is one of those rare examples. There are actually very few examples out there of pronounced differences between population groups. You know, again, like you mentioned, Ashkenazi Jews and Tay Sachs is another one, but we don't actually have that many. And it's generally in communities that are very, very closed. You know, so these are diseases that pass through a family because obviously we are genetically more related to the people that we are related to our immediate family. If you live in a very small community, then you're obviously going to all share your genes with each other.
Right. Like hemophilia, that we see in white people, but it's really just a closed population of white people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you do see these conditions. And this is why in India, because of the caste system, there are a lot of endogamous groups in India. And you do see very strange, bizarre diseases crop up in certain communities because of this, of the closed nature of communities. And it means because there isn't that same kind of genetic mixing, very odd conditions can pop up.
Well, Angela, this was a fantastic conversation. We really appreciate you coming on the show. We never actually got to your second book. Maybe we'll have to bring you back and talk about how science got women wrong. But thanks again. This is obviously a very difficult issue, but I think it's an incredibly enlightening one. Like, if you really try to wrap your head around it, it tells you so much about the ills that are plaguing humanity and maybe illuminating a way forward. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Got three regular news items, no theme. You guys ready?
Yep.
Here we go. Item number one, archaeologists have used ground-penetrating radar to map an ancient city in northern Italy that is at least 3,000 years old and from a previously unknown culture. Item number two, researchers have developed an implantable therapeutic neural stimulator that is wireless and does not require a battery, magnetic coil, or radio waves for power. And item number three, a new study finds that conservatives, but not liberals, react to government warning labels by being more likely to engage in the unhealthy behavior. Bob, why don't you go first?
Oh, boy. All right. Let's see. Archaeologists use ground-penetrating radar to map an ancient city in northern Italy. 3,000? Ooh, and from previously unknown culture. Ooh, I want that to be true. So maybe it is. All right. It sounds plausible. That's all I can say. Researchers have developed an implantable therapeutic neural stimulator. Sounds very Star Trekian. That is wireless. Does not require battery, magnetic coil, or radio waves. What could it use? Fusion? Probably not. Implantable therapeutic neural stimulator. Ooh, I like it. I don't know. Okay, new study. Conservatives, but not liberals, react to government warning labels by being more likely to engage in the unhealthy. I guess I can see that too. Oh, crap. I can see all these. Let's say that the neural stimulator is fiction. Blah.
Okay, Evan.
The ground penetrating radar mapping ancient cities, they've been doing this. I've read stuff about this happening in like South America, where they're finding a lot of things that they would otherwise not be able to detect. I have a feeling this will turn out to be the same. A neural stimulator that is wireless, does not require a battery, magnetic coil, or radio waves.
what's powering it? Jeez, you kind of eliminated everything. I don't know about that one. I'm leaning towards Bob being that fiction, but the last one, oh boy. Study finds that conservatives react to government warning labels by being more likely to engage in the unhealthy behavior. The conservative parts of me wish that this were fiction. It's probably true. I guess I'll go with Bob. I'm going to say, because I don't know what's powering this neural stimulator. If you've ever taken out the battery, magnetic coil, radio waves, what's left? The human body? Fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right, the first one here about the archaeologists and the 3,000-year-old. Now, you're saying over here, Steve, what technology are they using to penetrate the ground?
Ground-penetrating radar.
Exactly. Now, what if I just don't believe that radar exists wholesale? There's no radar.
Mm-hmm. Well, then spell it backwards, and you'll be all set.
This would have to be the fiction.
No, but I don't. I believe in radar, and I think this one is science. I'm sure we have technology that can do that. The second one, researchers that developed this implantable therapeutic neural stimulator. Yeah, I agree. Like, you know, what would it be? The only thing I can think of is it would be pulling energy off of our heat somehow, right? What else could it possibly be using? And that one's I'm really iffy about. I'm not finding any problem with the last one, saying that you know, conservatives are more likely than liberals or not liberals are going against government warning labels. That one seems legit to me as well. So I'll say that the second one about the neuroimplantable therapeutic situation is false.
Okay, and Kara.
Wait, is that everybody?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So far.
Like you all agreed on the same one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, crap.
Yep, she's got it.
Are you going to buck the trend?
I think I'm going to buck the trend.
Ooh, very bold. Very bold.
I can see the first. I can see the ancient city, 3,000 years old. I mean, we're at 2020 right now. So, okay. Something BCE. I can see, and like I hear all the time, and it's like Italy and Egypt. That's where they're always digging stuff up. They just keep going, and there's just more stuff. The implantable therapeutic neural stimulator. Yeah, I feel like there's just something that could be powering it that we're not thinking of. But this one about the conservatives, but not liberals. So it reminds me of the light bulb study. And I know in the light bulb study, conservatives, but not liberals were like, screw your LED. I'm going to go for the old school incandescent when there was a label that said this is better for the environment. But that's different than a food. You're talking a food warning label, right?
It could be food. It could be don't smoke. Just anything health related.
Right. But it's health. Yeah, right. Health related, so it's different than environmental impact. And I feel like there's nothing political about I don't want to eat trans fats. There's nothing political about something that's actually unhealthy. Maybe if we're talking about GMO labels, there could be something interesting. But if something says like this is going to raise your cholesterol, I don't see why there would be a difference between conservatives and liberals. So I'm going to say that that's the fiction.
All right. So Kara's striking out on her own. So you guys all agree with the first one. So we'll start there. Archaeologists have used ground penetrating radar to map an ancient city in northern Italy that is at least 3,000 years old and from a previously unknown culture. You all think that one is science. And that one is the fiction.
Oh, no! Crap, you swept us!
Steve!
No!
Well, what was it?
So the ground-penetrating radar is correct. Could that exist?
Yes.
And so archaeologists did find a city, and they mapped out. This is the first time they used a new technique of the ground-penetrating radar that allowed them to map an entire city in high detail, but it's a Roman city, and it's only from about 700 years ago.
Oh.
So this is in the name of the city is Falerii Novi, about 31 miles north of Rome. It's about half the size of Herculaneum. But
I've been there. It's awesome.
Now why would they use ground penetrating radar
to preserve whatever's above it so they don't have to destroy it?
Yeah, that's part of it, but it's also sometimes they just can't because there's modern stuff on top of it. You know, you can't dig up an existing city to see what's underneath it. So,
sure they can.
Yeah. But the other thing is, so this technique, though, not only is it non-destructive, but it also allows you to image different layers. So they were able to see this city evolving over centuries.
Neat.
You know?
Cool. Building
and
on top of itself.
They were, yeah, well, they were neat. Also able to image the water ducts, like the pipelines.
quack.
Sure, sure.
And from an archaeological
why did they quack?
From an archaeological point of view, what was interesting about this was that the city was laid out fairly differently than other ancient Roman cities. So they thought there was more variability in, you know, city design and functionality than they had thought. So it was pretty cool. You could see like there's a market and a temple and a bathhouse and theaters and shops and atrium houses. You know, it's really cool.
Neato.
You take a look.
I read that news item, Steve, and I got it wrong.
Yeah.
What? you know how it kind of drifts into like no man's land in the back of your head. You're like, oh yeah, I read that. That's science. Yeah. I didn't.
That's what Steve was counting on.
The thing that, you know, I was thinking would be the trigger was the unknown culture. It's like, really? This people we didn't know about were living in Italy 3,000 years ago? No. I'm not totally implausible or impossible, but that would be a big, big, big find. But anyway, let's move on to number two. Researchers have developed an implantable therapeutic neural stimulator that is wireless and does not require a battery, magnetic coil, or radio waves for power. This is science. I forgot to include in there that it's smaller than a grain of rice. This thing is tiny.
Ooh,
wow.
Nice.
How is it powered? So that's the real question. So that is the new bit here. This is, you know, researchers just spent years developing this technology and miniaturizing it so that you can get this implantable, you know, therapeutic. When I say therapeutic, meaning it's stimulating neurons in a power and frequency that of current therapeutic devices, right? Whether it's
how localized probably is local. This activity, right? Very local, I would think.
Yeah,
but that's what you want.
Smaller than a grain of rice. So that's how localized it is. So the power, this is the new bit, right? So there's two layers. One layer is magnetic and the other one is piezoelectric. Now, it doesn't use magnetic coils.
But a magnetic field.
Just a magnetic field. And if you give a magnetic field of the right power of the right, because the magnetic coils directly induce current, but they're big and bulky and whatever, and they cause heat. That's a big problem. You don't want to cause heat. But this is just like if you have a magnetic field, the magnetic device there's a specific phenomenon where at the right frequency the magnetic material will vibrate, right? It'll hum. They say like you may have heard a transformer humming. It's like, okay, I know about that phenomenon, but I don't know if I've ever heard it myself in the world. Yeah. But then there's a second layer. What do you think? And the second layer is piezoelectric. So you make the magnetic layer vibrate, and then those vibrations generate electricity in the piezoelectric layer.
Right.
So it's that combination. Jesus. Yeah, clever,
Can
right?
you scale that up? Can you scale that up?
Well, I don't know for what purpose. It's great for powering a remote, tiny device. Why would you want to scale it up? It's just adding multiple layers of transferring energy.
Clean energy for Bob's house.
You could put a bigger one in a whale's brain.
Bob, you're my favorite.
If this technology pans out, this could be really a really good way of, you know, stimulating the brain with such devices, right? And what we're trying to figure out, how do we get electric devices in the brain without having wires and without them heating up and without batteries that will go dead, et cetera. So this may pan out. I think it was tested in a mouse, and so it looks pretty cool. All right. All this means that a new study finds that conservatives but not liberals react to government warning labels by being more likely to engage in the unhealthy behavior is science. Kara, I think that your analysis was reasonable, but I think the bit that you're missing is the two words government warning.
Government, yeah. Right. So it's specific. Yeah, but it's like, I don't know, man. I feel like conservatives, they'll look at USDA grade beef and they're like, that is not something I should not eat.
So I
think it depends.
But that's not a warning.
But they controlled. They controlled that. So if it was if the warning was coming from the company, they were fine with that. Or if it was a government label not a warning, they were okay with that too. But when you combined the two, when it was a government warning, that triggered their freedom. Like, the government's
don't
not going to
tread on me, man. That's
Yeah, exactly. And so that had a backfire effect. They were more positive towards the thing, or they expressed more of a willingness to engage in that behavior.
That's so stupid.
You triggered them.
They were triggered. Dangerous to your health,
triggered.
And they're like, I should buy it.
Yes. Screw that.
But they were okay with a company telling them, you know, not to do it. Or they were okay if it was just information. Like if it was just a label of information, that's okay too. But as soon as the government tells you, don't do this, they're like, screw that, I'm going to do it. You can't take away my freedom.
Freedom to do something that's detrimental to my health.
Oh,
I love it.
But, you know, that's all wrapped up in conspiracy theories and not trusting the government and, you know, sure. Whatever.
Yeah, but that's why I'm kind of surprised, because there's so many different flavors of conservative, right? Like conspiracy theorists are like a very small percentage, and people who just like all out don't trust, you know, the government or trust authority. That's a small percentage. Most conservatives just want smaller government, not they don't think the government is like, you know.
That's more of a classical conservative, yeah.
Exactly. So, but I figured that
enough. This was enough to have a net backlash.
Amazing. But you guys do remember the light bulb study, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, when they're like, this one is better for the environment. They were like, screw that, I'm buying the other one.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually like a news segment on Fox News where they do that, you know.
What?
What? Yeah, seriously, they, you know, it's like, we're going to trigger the libs by like putting straws in steaks and whatever, you know. Just
straws.
That's a literal bit.
No, that is parody. Bit. That is no
self parody.
It's what is it? Poe's Law.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
All right. So, I was hoping you guys were going to think it was so obvious it had to be the fiction. You know what I mean? Like I'm trying to suck you in with a skeptical.
Oh, that would have been my next choice. Certainly, yeah. You totally got me on the.
all right, Evan, give us a quote.
The archaeology one. All right. Supplied this week by our listener, Ronan from Ontario, Canada.
Ronan.
Thanks, Ronan. And he says, because I'm into martial arts, that he thought I might appreciate this quote. And I do appreciate it. Thank you. Truth is not what you want it to be. It is what it is, and you must bend to its power or live a lie.
Ooh.
Yes, written by Miyamoto Musashi, who was a 16th and 17th century Japanese philosopher, among other things, a prominent swordsman. Entire styles and techniques that are credited to him. He's considered a Ronin and a Kensei, which is a sword saint of Japan.
Sounds like a cool guy.
Yeah, yeah, overall.
Yeah, Ronin is a samurai that without a master, right? Without a lord or a master. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
So very cool. Love it when other cultures and other time periods also dabble in skepticism. We can learn something from them all.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like one of those obvious self-evident things, but even today it needs to be said, you know, there is only
absolutely
one truth.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's not all what right. You want it to be. Yep.
Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Good job, everybody. Nice. Steve.
Swept.
Good episode.
Yeah. We will see you all on Friday at our live stream.
Yay. Can't wait.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.